And welcome to another episode of the Back in Session podcast with your hosts, Ryan Stevens and
Ryan Demare.
What's going on, Ryan?
Eagles redeemed themselves.
Kind of.
How'd the Giants do?
Yeah, don't want to talk about it.
I heard it was like an epic meltdown. Is that true?
I've been struggling
Is
the
that
last
accurate?
couple of days. You know, I've been a New York Giants football fan my entire life. I don't know. I mean, that was just bad because I knew the Giants could win.
Is it true that New York teams haven't had a championship in 5,000 days?
I mean, that's actually not true. I
It's
know that's a
not.
graphic. That's a graphic going around
So it's
on
not.
social media, but it's not true.
What's incorrect? Fact check it.
There are, I don't know off the top of my head, but it's like soccer, women's basketball, the WNBA team that's there, which I admittedly don't even know who they are or what soccer team it
Okay,
is, but I'm pretty
I'll
sure
say
those teams have
5,000
won.
days without your sports teams winning a championship.
That is more accurate, correct?
Okay. That's all I care about anyway.
Yeah.
I don't care if all of New York is unhappy, just if you are.
Just me. Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, this weekend we've got the Giants going to Philly. Maybe we should go to the game together.
Maybe we should.
We should.
Do you think
We could
do the podcast out of the, like, we
we could
could
do a
tailgate
we could do a
from the
podcast at the
lot?
link. I'll get eggs thrown at me. Maybe a couple of people shooting me the bird if I'm wearing my Giants jersey. But I actually got my parents surprised me this weekend. They brought, I didn't even know that they kept it, but my old Giants like starter jacket from when I was like
Oh, there you go.
two or three. So they gave it to me to give to my son. So he's fully invested in the Giants. Every time there's a football game on, he goes, "Go Giants," even if
He's
the
not
Giants
old
aren't
enough to know
playing.
but he's not old enough to know better yet. That'll change.
We could throw a random college football game on and he's going, "Go Giants, touchdown,
Yeah.
touchdown." So he's getting it, but
There you go.
yeah. So, but again, you guys aren't here to listen to us talk about our sports teams. So
They're
we
not.
are, I mean, maybe
Maybe.
again, we should do a little deviation, just do sports talk, because that's what I feel like
A
we could actually,
spinoff.
people would actually find that entertaining. I don't know if our regularly scheduled programs are, you know, but anyways, yeah, we've got some guests coming on from the Susquehanna River Basin Commission. So I know a lot of folks might not know exactly who the SRBC is and what they do, but we're really excited to welcome them on. Drew and Stacy are going to be coming on to talk about the work that they do at the SRBC. So we're looking forward to it, and hope everybody enjoys. All right, Drew and Stacy, welcome to the Back in Session podcast. How are you both doing today?
Awesome.
Doing great. Glad
Well,
to be here.
We appreciate you guys both coming on. Just to get things started, can you both just quickly introduce yourselves and talk about your roles at the SRBC and how you ended up there?
Yeah, sure. I'll start. Drew Dayhoff. I'm the executive director here at SRBC. I've been here for a little over 30 years. I actually started as an intern. My background is in water resources engineering, so I've done a little bit of everything here at the commission, flood and drought planning, water regulation, hydrology studies, things like that. So, but now my role is to really serve as the liaison between the technical staff and our commissioners at the state and federal level.
And I'm Stacey Hanrahan. I spent the majority of my career as a journalist, but probably about 4 or 5 years ago. Actually, I don't think anybody at SRBC has heard this story, but probably about 6 months before this position came open, I was in Sedona, Arizona, actually, and I was in one of those Native American sweat lodges, and I was talking about what I wanted to do next, and I didn't know, but I was like, I think the next thing I definitely want to do, I want it to serve Mother Nature. And then 6 months later, you know, this position came open, which was quite different than news, even though it is communications that I do. And I went for it, and here I am about 4 years later. But I do communications and outreach for SRBC.
Well, hopefully the staff at SRBC listens to this episode, so they will hear about that story.
We'll make up.
Exactly. Well, for our listeners who might not be familiar, what exactly is the Susquehanna River Basin Commission, and how is it structured and funded?
So, kind of a short history lesson. So, back in the 1960s, there were a few issues that were emerging in the Susquehanna River Basin. We'd had a prolonged drought in the early 60s to mid 60s that was concerning. And then Baltimore and Chester, both cities, they began withdrawing large amounts of water from the Susquehanna River. And they're not even in the basin. They had actually built pipelines to the river and were taking quite a bit of water. At that same time, Three Mile Island and Peach Bottom, the nuclear power plants, they were under construction. And it was known that they were going to be using vast amount of water. I mean, millions and millions of gallons a day each. So that was a concern. And then at that time, also in the 60s, there was a growing awareness of concerns about the health of the bay, the Chesapeake Bay, and the river actually contributes 50% of the fresh water to the bay. So what happens upstream, what happens to the river, happens to the bay. So all those things were kind of coming together in the 60s. And the solution was an interstate government agency. And so New York, Maryland, PA, which are the three basin states, and the federal government got together and they created a compact. And then that compact was signed into law, actually by President Nixon, on Christmas Eve of 1970. So we were originally formed to regulate water withdrawals and to protect against droughts. But I mean, I'd say that our main responsibility over the years has been to balance economic development, which is, of course, always going to happen, with a sustainable, healthy environment. And
Yeah, absolutely. And the compact that the three states and the federal government signed that Stacy mentioned, it laid out some pretty broad authorities in those areas. And we use that as our guide to determine what types of activities we'll undertake. And that's with the oversight of three states and the federal government. Each of them has a seat on our board of commissioners, if you want to call it that. Typically or technically under the compact, it's the three governors and the president. But as you might imagine, they appoint other people to serve in their place. So that's really the structure. They the four of them help us take the duties in the compact and identify our annual priorities and give us the go ahead and some direction on how to pursue those. We at the onset 54 years ago were largely funded by the four parties to get us off the ground, but they pretty much had the expectation that we would be grow to be self-sustaining. So today we're funded about 10% by the signatory parties, but the other revenue comes from regulatory fees and grants about equally. We have cobbled together different sources of revenue to accomplish whatever our priorities happen to be.
Yeah, and with it spanning multiple states and communities, how do you all coordinate across those different jurisdictions? And what do you think some of the key differences are in how each state approaches water management?
Great question. It is a challenge, and to Stacy's point, that's kind of why they said, we want to create this commission so we can coordinate those and work together. Each of our programs, whether it's regulatory planning, floods and droughts, or water quality monitoring, they each maintain really close contact with their counterparts at the state and federal agencies. And as you kind of alluded to, that can be a challenge because they're all structured differently. One activity is housed in a department that has a completely different name than it might in the other states. But the underlying focus is the same. So just by identifying the right people, get those people together in work groups and committees, we share information and coordinate on our various activities. And we do that really at two levels. Our scientists connect to their counterparts at the technical program level, and then I and other managers connect to our counterparts at the policy level. And then through our quarterly meetings with our commissioners, and that provides a forum for them to all talk to each other. There, like I said, there are some differences in structure, but management isn't too different. The underlying goals are the same, even though there are some unique focus areas. For example, Maryland is very focused on the Chesapeake Bay, obviously. And while that's important in Pennsylvania, just as an example, the legacy of coal mining is a huge focus for Pennsylvania. So different sort of focused activities, but in this example, the goal is the same, and that's improved water quality.
Yeah, and Stacey mentioned it earlier briefly. regarding water use for like the nuclear power plant down at Three Mile Island. We'll flash forward to now in 2025, water use regulation becoming a very complex and especially with the rise of data centers, right? So what emerging challenges or trends are you seeing in water allocation and sustainability?
Data centers are actually a great example of some of those complexities and challenges. There's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to be built, how much water they're going to use. There's a lot of variability in the water demand and the availability of local supplies to meet that demand. And that variability extends across both time of year and location. It isn't all cookie cutter. Generally, our area of the country has plenty of water to meet growing demands. But the reality is, you don't always get it where and when you need it. And a big challenge is that that variability and uncertainty seems to be becoming more extreme and unpredictable with climate change and other swings.
Yeah, and I would just add that, hyperscale data centers, while they're new to the basin, new industries aren't new to SRBC, if that makes sense. So, like a great example is what was it, 15, 20 years ago now when fracking came to town. So there was a lot of concern on for various reasons, but there was especially concern for us as how much water is this industry actually going to use. Well, we were able to quickly handle that, adapt, even alter some of our regulations in order to ensure that, the water resources were going to be protected. So, whereas, yeah, definitely, industry is always going to change. We're always going to see new things. So that's one of the things I think we pride ourselves on is just being able to adapt to it.
Are there data centers online right now in the basin that are utilizing water from the Susquehanna?
There are actually quite pretty many data centers operating and have been for years, but they're doing sort of the basic internet searching and cloud storage that doesn't require a lot of computing power and therefore doesn't require a lot of water for cooling. But what we're seeing for like artificial intelligence and some of the other things is what they're calling hyperscale data centers, and that's where it's really emerging. There aren't any currently operating in the basin. We've issued a permit for one to operate, but getting back to the uncertainty, we just you see the headlines in the papers too. They're popping up everywhere. A lot of it's speculative. So we're really trying to work with our counterparts in other states where it has happened, like Northern Virginia and the Atlanta area, to get a handle on what to expect and try to get out in front of it.
SRBC also engages in a lot of on-the-ground work. Can you talk about some of the programs your staff works on outside of your regulatory responsibilities?
Sure. So I often talk about upstairs, downstairs in our building because upstairs is most of our regulatory staff. We have project review that reviews applications and water projects. We actually have a compliance department as well that ensures that the permits that are handed out that the water users are adhering to that. We actually have a office in Sayre. Which is on the border of New York and Pennsylvania, which we opened when fracking started so that we could be closer to that industry. And there's a lot of compliance staff that works out of there. But then downstairs. So then there's the downstairs staff, which are rarely downstairs. There are a lot of them are out in the field. So there's planning and operations, and then there is monitoring and protection. Monitoring and protection does a lot of water quality work. So they help fill gaps with water quality monitoring for agencies like DEP and EPA. They do things like eDNA work, which is environmental DNA. So they track invasive fish that are coming up into the Susquehanna River Basin. Like, I don't know if you guys fish at all, like blue catfish or the northern snakeheads. We have a SIM network, it's CIM, it's continuous in-stream monitoring, which is one of the largest basin-specific real-time water quality monitoring networks in the nation, actually. One of the other cool things that we do is American eel restoration. I don't know if you guys know what an American eel is. People think they think they're snakes. They look like snakes. They're not. They're fish. They have gills. But the American eel is born actually in the Atlantic Ocean. And once born, some go east to Europe, some come west to the Americas. And They like to come up the Susquehanna River into our basin. But the problem is that in the early 1900s, we as people built four run-of-river dams that are on the lower Susquehanna River. And where eels are really good at climbing and could probably climb out of your fish tank at home, they cannot scale the 100-foot-tall Conowingo Dam, which is the first dam that they encounter when they're coming up the river in Maryland, just below the Pennsylvania border. So we partnered with federal and state agencies to basically trap them and truck them around the dams and put them back into the Susquehanna River Basin because their population is very important to the ecosystem. And actually, out of that, the Eels in the Classroom program was born. Aaron Henning, who is one of our fisheries biologists, he started this program with schools about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. I think we missed 1 year because of COVID. But basically, we give about 10, they're called elvers, they're eels, they're about 1 to 3 years old whenever they reach the dams. And we put them in classrooms and the kids raise them and they learn about their importance. And at the end of the year, we have what are called eel releases. They're big educational parties where the kids release the eels back into the system. I put them back into the river and into the streams near their schools. So I could definitely talk forever about different things that we do. Maybe Drew wants to mention what planning and operations handles downstairs.
Yeah, I always like to talk about non-regulatory programs. Those programs probably do get a lot of the a lot of the attention and maybe what we're best known for. I get it. No one likes to be permitted, but the point of the permits is not to restrict water use. It's just to ensure sustainable development, and that the users have the information they need. So a lot of the other things we do in some of our non-regulatory programs are geared towards being a scientific resource for decision makers. You know, I mentioned the variability of water availability. So we do studies that kind of indicate where water might be available and how much during a drought. That's really when push comes to shove, and that's when you have to make some tough decisions. So we try to assemble some information that shows what areas are more vulnerable, particularly, you know, to a drought, and where conflicts may arise, and help communities use that information for planning, you know, how to zone and where to plan for different land uses. And a recent study that I was really excited about relates to that. It's called it was the identification of critical aquifer recharge areas. So kind of a mystery of water is that, maybe think about streams, maybe in your backyard or something, you cross a bridge over. When it's not raining, why is there water in that stream? That's because rain from 6 months or a year ago percolated into the ground and recharged aquifers, which have fractures that transmit water following gravity and eventually intercept a stream somewhere. So preserving that infiltration of rainwater into our underground storage basically is what keeps our streams flowing when there isn't rain. And really, it's important to know that when communities are planning where to allow the next Walmart to develop. You know, if you can preserve those areas that are providing the most recharge, that really helps all of us with maintaining sustainability during droughts.
I feel like I'm back in school. I'm learning a lot
Exactly.
Science class.
There's not a test at the end of this, right?
You never know.
And I also need to,
101.
I need to make sure I know what schools in the area have the Eels in the Classroom program, because I have a son under two, and my wife and I are talking about moving at some point in the next year or two, and I would love to make sure that he's in a school district that has that program. I think that'd be pretty cool.
It's awesome. We'll hook you up.
People have been known to abuse their relationship with Stacy to kind of convince
True.
get a school added to the list. So
There we
it
go. There we go.
happened.
I'm glad we're doing this then.
All who you
Yeah,
know, Ryan. It's all who you know.
and this topic has come up a little bit, but shifting gears, flooding and droughts are recurring problems and offer challenges throughout the basin. How does SRBC coordinate efforts and share data between state and local partners to help prepare for or respond to flooding and drought instances?
Yeah, so it's interesting actually that I told you earlier how we were formed out of drought concerns, But then very shortly after we were formed, so we're formed in 1970, and then what happened in 1972? Tropical Storm Agnes. So all of a sudden we had the opposite problem. So it was like, oh, whoa, let's shift gears. And now we need to focus on flooding. So we started creating flood inundation maps. Also in the 1980s, we worked with National Weather Service and USGS to launch an early flood warning system. What we do when it comes to flooding and droughts is a lot on the coordination side. You know, it's before the event happens. It's the prevention tools. It's not necessarily the, you know, it's not the response or the recovery that happens afterwards. Because you think about that, that's EMA, emergency management. That's PEMA, right? Which is a good point to either repeat or to really press upon is that, you know, our founders, you know, that created the SRBC, they took great care to not overlap our duties and our responsibilities with other agencies, right? So, you know, we don't want duplication when it comes to government agencies. So, you know, that's why we kind of have our little, you know, very specific role when it comes to those
numbers. Yeah, and we can be sort of the liaison between the various agencies. So the National Weather Service produces really sophisticated forecasting, but that needs to be translatable and usable by the local emergency responders. So we are sometimes out in communities talking to those people and learning what they need to know, what format and what how to package the information from forecasters in ways that can best help them respond. So that's a sort of a unique role that we have developed over the years.
How does SRBC's work impact everyday residents and businesses across the basin, and what are some of the real world effects that people might notice?
Great question. It does, although maybe behind the scenes. I think it's first very useful to emphasize that everything either uses, touches, impacts, or relies on water. Some of those are very obvious, like your drinking water when you turn on the tap, irrigating crops, but then sort of what people don't realize is that every manufacturing facility needs water, either for washing or processing or steaming or cooling, you name it. Power generation is by far the largest user of water in the basin, which I think largely people don't realize. And again, that is for cooling the steam so they can recycle it. And then land use and development impacts water resources. You know, what happens on the land impacts how rainfall reacts and what that, you know, can do to our streams. So it's all inseparable from everything humans do. We impact the water, and water impacts our abilities to function as a society. So really the our science and our regulations allow us collectively to continue operating in the way we want to during droughts. It's not just environmental protection, although that's an important component, but it helps avoid conflicts between water users. That's our sister agency, the Delaware River Basin Commission, really came into being because of litigation between New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New York. So we're a conduit, as is DRBC now, to avoid that type of infighting. So, you know, bottom line is we provide data to understand potential impacts of new development and how best to accommodate it. So we fill those technical gaps, coordinate between the agencies, serve as a conduit for cooperation and interstate management. You know, no one wants an outcome where we can't generate electricity or turn on our taps because of a drought or water use conflict. So it is really an important function that we have that impacts everyday life and ensures that we can, you know, have you know, environmental, economic, and sociological continuations.
And we're lucky in a way that we exist here. We talked about also DRBC, you know, in the Delaware River Basin, in the Susquehanna River Basin, because there aren't commissions like us across the country. You think there would be, but there are not. So you hear about, you know, you read in the paper, I guess you're not reading the paper anymore, you hear in the news that, you know, quote unquote, water wars, you know, out west. If you're upstream, if you're the state upstream, you tend to win out, you know. Well, that's not happening here. So in that way, we are lucky to be residents of this basin because the states did come together 50 plus years ago and said, no, we're going to work together instead of fight over this. So,
yeah, that's fascinating. I just would have assumed that there would be similar organizations all across the country.
Really?
Wow. Well, I, as a resident within the basin, I definitely appreciate all the work you guys are doing. But are there any misconceptions about SRBC or its role that you all frequently encounter?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main one for me, just because I'm communications and I get it all the time, is when we get inquiries about water quality powers, I guess, because we don't regulate the water quality. We don't have that authority. So, I mean, I can tell you that there's, and also just from our name, Susquehanna River Basin Commission, I can't tell you how many times working in news here, where before I came to work here, I actually got it wrong on what SRBC does. I'd call them for everything. I'd call and they'd say, no, you want Harrisburg River Rescue for that situation. Or, or if there was some serious water quality violation, then, I needed to call DEP, obviously. So I think that's probably the one misconception, the main one that I get on the communication side of things.
Another big one from just an organizational level, as we just alluded to, we're a kind of a unique type of organization. So people are often like, are you state? Are you federal? Are you a nonprofit? Are you non-governmental?
Oh, yeah.
We really are basically just an extension of the states and the federal government, and sometimes understood and maybe not fully appreciated that our rules and regulations have the same level of authority as those entities. We're really just doing it on their behalf. They could, anytime, they could take it back and say, we don't need you anymore, and that would be fine. But we really are not only working for them, but also accountable to them. People think sometimes that we're just kind of out here doing our own thing, but we really do work hard to fulfill the functions they expect of us and not duplicate their efforts.
From an advocacy and policy standpoint, what are some of your key priorities right now? Are there any legislative or regulatory changes that you are all tracking?
I think the easiest way to answer that is to circle back to data centers. As we've discussed, there's so much activity surrounding that right now, but a lot of it's speculation and uncertainty. So we're just trying to stay in front of it. We admittedly have a narrow focus on water. There are other aspects of that, power, land use. But for us, what is the pertinent information about likely water use? How many data centers might there be? Where might they locate? The big thing is, what type of cooling technology will they use? Because that's really the largest source of water use, and that technology is evolving all the time. So we're trying to be a resource for that type of information. And certainly, there will be a regulatory hook on them for us if they use sufficient amounts of water, which we're trying to discourage, encouraging better technologies, and that technology does exist. But in addition to us, there will be a lot of decisions made at the local level. There's state permitting as well. But, at the level like townships, where some of these decisions are being made, this is new to them. So we're really working hard and tracking, what's happening and how they're responding. There are some bills coming out of the General Assembly, or at least being proposed, that will get to, these types of information from various aspects. And to the extent we can be a resource to kind of consult on, any that touch on water, does it make sense? What information can we provide? We really want to just be a part of that conversation. Encourage, don't just talk about power demands and fiber optic lines and tax credits or whatever. All important factors, but also include water as part of the conversation, please.
Yeah, and going back in time a little bit, a couple years ago, was the SRBC involved in the passing of legislation that made the Eastern Hellbender the state amphibian of Pennsylvania? And why was that effort important?
we were not directly involved.
Okay.
We definitely thought it was pertinent designation to make. Like so many other topics that I've mentioned, we were a source of information. Yes, we can confirm that hellbenders are present in the basin, but really only in our most clean and clear streams, and that has to do with the way the hellbenders reproduce. They need a very clean substrate, rocks and things to lay their eggs on. So why I thought it was important was it highlighted the important ecological functions of some of our forested streams, some of the undeveloped areas of the basin, and how truly sensitive the aquatic ecology there can be to land development. If it's not done, in sustainable ways, you can alter natural stream flow patterns and increase temperatures, and allow the introduction of too much sediment into the waterways. So it really is a sort of like the canary in the coal mine. If you have hellbenders, That's a really clean stream, and it's important to know what you can do to maintain that.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is because before working for Duane Morris, I worked in the State House for Representative Cheryl DeLosier, and that was actually her bill. I think Senator Jean Yaw's bill in the Senate was the one that was signed into law, but I remember seeing SRBC's name on a lot of informational pieces that we got. And actually have seen the Hellbender still in the offices for Representative DeLosier and Senator Yaw. They still have the stuffed Hellbenders, which I always find interesting when I'm
Yeah,
visiting
we
them.
have a sort of a real life a replica of
Yeah.
Hellbender. It looks real. And that's one of the most popular displays when Stacy's
Oh
out in the
yeah. The
public.
kids love it. It's
Yeah.
not, also I should, disclaimer, it's not stuffed. These ones, because
Ours
we're
are
trying
not,
to
right?
protect them. Yeah, I don't know about other people. It is just a plastic
Right.
mold. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
So transparency and public engagement are super important to your mission. You all even have a live river cam and different data dashboards that are accessible to the public. How do you all utilize tools like these to help build trust and public awareness?
Yeah, I guess I could tell you. I think we could talk about the more boring stuff like public hearings and federal registries and things like that. We do everything that we need to have a very robust public participation forum and opportunities. If you go on our website, you could be there for days, I think, because of the amount of information that we put out to the public. We think that's very important. Certainly, I am always pushing that message as a former journalist. Although I don't have to do much, when I came in, they were already there. So that was a good thing. But I think the thing that I always like to tell people is that we're extremely accessible. And at the end of the day, there's 65 people that work for
62.
us, 62 people. So we're a lot smaller of an agency. After you hear everything that we do, it's like, wow, okay, wait, you only have 62 people there. So we're very accessible. And in saying that, I can say, so for example, like say a new water bottling company moved in next door to you and you have a well, and so you're worried, and they're going to drill a well, or they want to drill a well, and they've come to us with an application and they want so much water from the basin, and you're really concerned about it. Not only do you have all of the opportunities to participate in public hearings and to let your voice be heard, but at the end of the day, we're going to put you in touch with the person or persons that are working on that application. You're going to be able to speak to them if you have that many questions. So, yeah, public the public being informed is extremely important to us, and being transparent is extremely important to us. The live river cam is just fun. That we I'm glad you mentioned that. We are right on Front Street, just into Susquehanna Township here, north of Harrisburg, right near the Rockville Bridge. If anybody is a train lover, you know it, because about, I don't know, 80 plus trains go over that bridge every day. So we have the camera pointing at the river and the train bridge. Some people do love that cam.
And we
Yeah,
also
I'm gonna have to
go
check that out. I actually didn't know you guys had a live cam, even though I just have to walk up the road and I can probably see it in person,
ahead. Right,
but
do both.
We also make ourselves accessible in terms of when we do set our priorities every couple of years, we do open it up to stakeholders. So we definitely want to do what our states, what their priorities are, but we also want to hear from the public. So we do offer listening sessions as we put together our our comprehensive plan and our strategic plans for the coming years.
No, that's great. And before we do wrap up, we always like to end with a fun question. So curious to get both of your thoughts. Do you have any favorite fun facts or surprising statistics about the Susquehanna River Basin that you think our listeners would enjoy?
Wow, yeah. See, I'm a water geek, so I could offer a lot of those, but just to yeah, something that I'll throw out there, and this is for history buffs too. I sometimes like to point out that the Susquehanna is one of the world's oldest rivers, and it's also said to be the largest river in the country that's non-navigable. And those two fun facts to a geek actually go hand in hand. Has to do with ancient geology, dramatic changes in sea levels, sea level when it was much lower than it is now. the Chesapeake Bay did not exist. That was just the Susquehanna River making its way to the Atlantic Ocean. So today, the bay is just the flooded Susquehanna. But also, millions of years ago, the ocean levels were much higher. So the coastline was much farther inland than it is now. And that is really the what they call the head of tide. When you get to the top of the Chesapeake Bay, that's when it becomes non-navigable because that was all under ocean and really eroded. But once you get up into the river from there, it's the land terrain and the slope of the river is much steeper. And it certainly was just not navigable by Captain John Smith in the 1600s or whenever. So that's interesting, I think, for the from that aspect. But while it was not navigable because of the steepness, that also made it ideal for the construction of the hydroelectric dams that Stacy mentioned. So it all kind of ties together for, you know, where we were and where we are today.
I was so mad. I 15 years ago, I moved here from Miami and I was in the Coast Guard Auxiliary and things like that, and big on the water. And I was like, oh, there's a river there. I'm gonna be able to put big boats on it. And I came up and I was like, wait, what? No, I can walk across it though. I
Yeah,
guess I'll be kidding.
my wife's uncle has a little piece of property a little north of Harrisburg, and he took us out on his pontoon boat a couple years ago when we first moved to Harrisburg, and yeah, I was shocked by how shallow some of the parts of the river are.
Sure.
So I get it. And I was actually just in Miami, so it was definitely a big difference. So I'm sure you probably miss it a little bit.
Yeah, I grew up in Pittsburgh and then lived in Miami for over a decade in my 20s. So that's all you need to know about
Yeah. On that note,
that. Correct.
well, no, Drew, Stacy, we really appreciate you both coming on to talk about the SRBC and what you all do and why it's important. I feel like I learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners did too. So, where can our listeners go to learn more about the SRBC?
Yeah, our website is www.srbc.gov.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan and
Thank
Ryan.
you.
And that concludes another episode of the Back in Session podcast. Enjoyed our conversation. Thought it was a good episode, Ryan.
Yeah, I'll say I did pull up the river cam. It's
Oh,
peaceful.
did you? Yeah, I'll have to do that or just look out my window
Or just look out your window.
because it is literally a couple hundred yards away, that bridge that they were talking about. Actually, I've been meaning to take Jax up there to take a look at the trains, and
Yeah, he'd love it.
there's a nice little like river walk basically that you can just go walk and enjoy the river. So, yeah, as a, like I said, as a resident of the river and an enjoyer of the river, have gone out on boats, kayaks, fished. It's a great
I'm
place to
always
be.
hearing you doing stuff on that river, so
Yeah. Maybe we'll do the podcast on the river next.
we keep coming up with all these creative, on the road podcast ideas, and we've never actually done one.
And we've never actually done them. Yeah, we should probably change that. So, on that note, until next time, when we will be back in session.